Welcome to this edition of the Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. Today we're going to be asking, what are the prospects for the economy? Is it really going to be as bad as a 35% hit to the UK economy? Is there going to be a swift bounce back? What should global policymakers be thinking about and doing? And what does the world on the other side look like after this phase of coronavirus? I'm delighted to say I'm joined by three brilliant economists to discuss this. Professor Sir Anton Muscatelli, Principal of the University of Glasgow. Andrew Wilson, founding partner at Charlotte Street Partners, and who's an old friend of mine. He was a young MSP in Edinburgh when I was a young newspaper journalist. Andrew chaired the Sustainable Growth Commission for the SNP. And David Skilling. David leads Landfall Strategy Group, which is an economic and policy advisory firm based in the Netherlands and Singapore. And I think I'm right in saying it has a particular focus on the exposure of small advanced economies to global economic and political dynamics. Firstly, coming to you, Anton, in your long career as an economist, this crisis we're living through is surely unlike anything you've ever encountered. How deep is the recession going to be, do you think?
Well, it's absolutely different from anything we've seen before, because we have never seen a crisis which hasn't been triggered either by, say, a financial crisis or an economic cycle, natural economic cycle, or indeed a disturbance like a war. This has been a kind of halting shock to many of the world's economies. And if you look at the sort of forecast we've seen, you were referring, I think, Ian, to the Office for Business Office for Budget Responsibilities scenario. They didn't call it a forecast. They published a scenario yesterday, which essentially predicts that in the second quarter, the UK will go into will lose 35% of its GDP. I believe the size of that shock, because I do think that the way they've built it up sector by sector, it doesn't actually make sense. What I find difficult to believe is that they then predict that if the lockdown doesn't continue or is unwound gradually in the third and fourth quarter, that will simply bounce back, because they're predicting in their scenario that there will be a recovery of GDP by early 2021. And I simply can't see that happen. And we can go into the reasons for that simply because they're assuming it doesn't have any lasting scarring impact on the UK economy. Yeah. And I really can't see that happening, to be honest.
David, what is, do you think, going on the ground in the UK in particular? What does a 35% fall, if it is that, that's the scenario, what does that look like economically?
Well, it's difficult to be too precise, because as Anton said, we haven't seen anything like that in living memory. Unemployment will shoot up. The numbers are horrifying, and that's true not just for the UK, but around the world. And that's also despite the government's best efforts in terms of various wage subsidy schemes and attempts to encourage firms to hold on to their labour force. But you are going to have a lot of people who are detached from employment. Obviously, people in the retail sector, hospitality sectors that are directly affected by the lockdown are going to be particularly exposed to this. And I would have to say, the longer this lockdown lasts for, and the longer that it takes to get the spread of the virus under control, the chances of a kind of a long-term scarring of people finding it more difficult to re-enter the labour market subsequently become higher and higher. And similarly for firms, you can't just sort of switch off and then switch back on again. There is a real chance, as we've seen in previous shocks of something approaching this magnitude, where these effects last for many years. And so this notion of a fairly rapid V-shaped recovery, where 2020 is ugly, in 2021 we begin to see the lights come back on, I think is optimistic. The nature of this virus is going to make rapid progress difficult. A vaccine is still some while away. It's likely that this thing will move in waves, as we've seen with previous pandemics, which is all to say that despite the government's best intentions and best hopes of getting the UK economy kind of back up and running in a gradual way, this is going to be very gradual. And the longer that this economy being in cold storage lasts for, the more damage will be imposed on firms, on workers, on households. So it's difficult to think of a precise comparison. The 1970s, the 1930s, and I guess the most recent one, a decade ago, the financial crisis, But I expect we're in for something significantly worse than we saw in the financial crisis, and potentially longer lasting as well.
And I suppose in a crisis like the Second World War, a shock like that, it then has other, the crisis has dynamic economic effects. You can switch to war production, even though borrowing is very high. There's a lot that the government needs to do that stimulates employment and economic activity. Whereas in this case, Andrew Wilson, there's just absolutely none of that. It's the economy being put into deep storage.
Yeah, well, we've effectively shut down, who knows the percentage, but let's say 90% of the market economy pretty much overnight. We don't know how long that will last for. In the meantime, one of the big issues I see that I think forecasters are missing is the gap between policy intent and implementation. So one of the things that we appear not to be great at in Britain is getting the money to flow either from the central bank or from government to where it needs to get to. You know, for example, the furlough scheme, which I have to say brought so much stress relief to small businesses across the country when the Chancellor announced it a couple of Fridays ago. I mean, that was dramatic in its comfort to people. But we can't even apply for it until the end of this month, and then we don't know when the money will flow. Meantime, businesses are struggling to get loans guaranteed from banks, and we haven't even begun to discuss direct support from the government for business survival. So the thing that I think is remarkable is it's singularly impossible for an economy to bounce back when big chunks of that economy don't exist anymore. And that's the simplest way to explain Anton's point, I think, which is there is just no chance that 2021 will see an economy that's bigger than 2019, which is what is in the OBR scenario. Now, it's not to criticise them, it's not to criticise city forecasters. I just don't think any forecast is meaningful at the moment. I think the way for us to think about this is how do we get through it? The shape of it matters more almost than the numbers. You know, it feels to me like a sharp contraction followed by a slow and probably wavy and probably jaggy ascent, and the economy we return to could be years off, but it must be in a very different shape from now. And I think the difficult thing for many reaction subscribers, I'm sure, and a lot of us will be to think, you know, all of the stuff we grew up with about the role of government, what it exists to do, is just bound to change. You know, that we know we've got scope in national debt to be a lot higher compared to the historic average, so that shouldn't be a big issue. We know that borrowing costs are lower than they've been probably ever before. We know that's true. But some of the normal rules of gravity still apply. You know, as we begin to solve for this crisis, the risks are very significant. And we need a completely different relationship between government and business and government and its citizens. And one of the things that troubles me as we move out of the immediacy of the health phase is that it doesn't strike me that a lot of policymakers are aware of what it is really like on the ground for SMEs in particular, or indeed even for the biggest of businesses. You know, in simple terms, you can't bounce back if your market's just contracted.
Yeah.
As the IMF said yesterday, we will lose an economy the size of Japan and Germany plus. So the world's got smaller, and then domestically, we've lost a stack, or we will lose a stack of small and medium-sized enterprises. A couple of retailers have gone bust today.
Yeah.
You know, some of these things would have been happening anyway. However, this has accelerated problems, and it's also accelerated, I suppose, reforms and renewals that have to happen, whether it's a more sustainable approach or whether it's a completely different relationship between the citizen and government.
But Andrew, you mentioned there the slow or the rapid response of government and the reality, which lots of people, lots of our listeners will be able to testify going through the system at the moment, is that it's just taking a very, very long time to deliver. Why is that? When you see, so internationally, if you look at somewhere like Switzerland and how quickly they seem to have turned around delivering what's effectively 20% of turnover to companies, as long as those companies were properly audited, the aid has been very, very swift. Why is it taken or still taking so long here?
Well, the short answer to that question is that I don't actually really know. My instincts are that our retreat from corporatism, which for many people, I'm sure on your subscriber list, seemed like a good idea at the time in the 80s and 90s, has left the lack of an infrastructure and relationship between economic agencies of government and the business. You know, we have business representative bodies who speak to government, but they don't. There's no plumbing involved. And another one which will come, I mean, I noticed this week the Pope, for example, saying that universal basic income was worth debating. And again, you don't actually need to go into the principles, the goods or the bads of that, but the actual idea that the government would have a direct financial plumbing relationship with every household and therefore be able to turn on or turn off support as was required feels attractive now in the midst of a pandemic in a way that it might have been worth debate before it. So I think these are the sort of big issues that we'll need, you know, the other way to put it, I mean, we will still have a debate between the left and the right, between big government and small government as time goes on. But what I think must change is that the infrastructure by which government does stuff is going to have to be cross-partisanly accepted, because I feel that our again, I'm not criticising one bit UK government. I think they acted reasonably swiftly on the economic side and they announced things which were important. I think more will be needed. I think the gap between intent and implementation is going to be where we fall foul. And so the secondary point is if too many people believe in a V-shaped recovery, the urgency for policymakers to do the big things, the radical things, the substantial things that are going to have to be done might be diminished. And it's a bit like the financial crisis where there was a bit of sleepwalking and I think, you know, all were guilty. I think if we can think our way through this more substantially, then we'll get a better policy response.
Just to come to David on this point, is it possible, do you think, and this maybe I'm being unnecessarily cynical or sceptical, is it possible that the government arranged its policy response in this way in the hope that they might have caught a lucky break and that things would have hit the peak sooner and that not all of this would need to be deployed? Because I think they're calculating costs of somewhere between 30 and 40 billion for every 3-month period. So if you had got to reopening about now or in a couple of weeks' time, companies that might not apply, the cost would be lower? Or do you think it is, as Andrew said, that we just don't have the bureaucratic setup or the plumbing?
I think, to be honest, it's more of a plumbing issue than anything else. I mean, these things are hard. I mean, as you said earlier, Switzerland's done it very well, Singapore's done it well, New Zealand's done it very well, often a matter of hours from application to money in bank account. So this can be done. It's obviously easier to do in smaller jurisdictions like those small countries than it might be in a larger, more complex country like the UK. But I think the gap here is really just more around processes and systems than anything else, because I think, you know, delaying this, hoping that the peak in virus infections will past you, I think it was pretty evident pretty early that was unlikely to be the case, right? And you just look around the world and you can see it. So I think it was more just a sort of a failing in implementation, which is a real problem now because, you know, for many firms, you know, cash flow is king. Liquidity is a real issue. If you don't have money in your bank account, you don't have that many choices. So, you know, the failure in implementation is going to have long-lasting economic effects. Countries that have done it well, you know, have supported businesses quickly, have got money in bank accounts, the economic fallout, the employment fallout will be mitigated compared to countries like the UK, unfortunately, and also the US, where they're having problems, where it's just taken longer to achieve.
Anton, just talk a little bit about the impact on the public finances and really, you know, can the public finances take it? And I take Andrew's point about the need to, these are extraordinary circumstances and these measures are necessary, but they're also very, very expensive. If the public finances can take it in the short term, can they take it, well, for how long?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question, you know, and I think a lot depends how long the crisis lasts. I think the kind of intervention we've seen so far from, say, the UK government and from similar governments, I think the UK does have the fiscal space. If you take the OBR force as, you know, a benchmark that sees, you know, deficit, public sector net borrowing rising to 14% of GDP, and it sees sort of debt to the GDP ratio, public sector net debt rising to about 95% of GDP, up from the 81% that we saw a few years ago, but still well below what will happen in many other countries. If you take projections for France, for Italy and Spain, France and Spain are probably going to end up somewhere around 130% of GDP, Italy possibly around 150, 155%. So the UK is closer to, say, Germany, where we still have some fiscal capacity to be able to do this. And as Andrew said, we actually have very low interest rates. The other factor is here how the central bank will work together in these jurisdictions with the fiscal authorities. So, you know, there's a lot already being done to avoid that big expansion in spending in the UK impacting directly in any way on liquidity or interest rates by expanding QE, by essentially making sure there's no problem with that additional borrowing in the short run. The question is how long it would take to unwind it. I'm quite sanguine about it. There's been quite a few economists have come in recently to say, well, look, in reality, given that this is going to be a considerable shock to the world economy, we shouldn't worry too much about things like inflation or whatever in the next 2 or 3 years, because that's unlikely to manifest itself. But I think it's going to require an extraordinary amount of cooperation between the central banks and the fiscal authorities in each of these jurisdictions. And it gets even more complicated, and I won't go into the details of what happens in Europe, because in the Eurozone it gets very complicated. But in those areas where the central bank, there is a national central bank, they'll work very, very closely with the fiscal authorities to make sure that there isn't a crisis of confidence in the next few years. But I worry less about the UK, to be honest, if providing this, this doesn't drag on beyond 2021. I do worry considerably for some other countries that are going to hit levels of debt unseen and may find it difficult unless there's a sharing of the burden. Can I just end on one point? There's a really good piece in terms of international cooperation, which was published, I think, just a couple of days ago, published by Adam Posen, who used to be a member of the Monetary Policy Committee, and by Maury Obstfeld, who was chief economist of the IMF. And both have said exactly something I've said recently in the press, which is, in this circumstance, you need absolute international cooperation. You need cooperation not to disrupt the supply chains around the world. I worry a lot about some of the statements from some countries saying we must have more autarky. You know, President Macron's sort of talk about making supply chains more French. Well, yes, that protects you from a shock, but after the shock has happened, actually what you want is you want to avoid any barriers going up, because that's going to make us all poorer. Secondly, you need to do something to help those emerging markets that are going to be desperately hit by the shock, because that actually will be the area where demand will come to get the economy, world economy, start again. So if we start, you know, again, making the mistakes of the 1930s, which is to allow funding to move from emerging markets back towards those industrialized economies, we will see a real damage being done to the world economy. And finally, in the G20, those that have fiscal capacity, like Germany, like Switzerland, like, you know, countries in the major economic blocks in the Eurozone, the more fiscally able country, UK to some extent, the US, should use those fiscal instruments, frankly, in the short run, but they should do so in a coordinated way.
David, how are you feeling about the Eurozone, strength of or otherwise, after the events of the last few weeks, where there was a compromise patched together and an agreement at the last moment last week? Is that just the beginning of the next phase of the crisis? Are they going to have to do it again, or have they fundamentally solved the problem or not?
Well, of course, they haven't fundamentally solved the problem. That's what the Eurozone does. The Eurozone kind of patches up, moves incrementally, and moves as quickly as domestic politics allow it to move. So, you know, a lot rests on implementation, on decisions that haven't yet been made. It's enough for now. But nor do I think the other end of the spectrum, that the Eurozone is destined for a blow-up, that Italy is going to collapse under a load of debt, and that the project will fail. I think there are ongoing stresses and challenges, and leadership will be required. But I think the Eurozone will continue to, if you like, muddle through. And we'll get there. It is worth noting, if you take the IMF predictions from yesterday, the Eurozone is amongst the worst affected affected region by coronavirus in terms of the GDP growth forecasts are marked down, I think, for 7.5%. So 7.5% contraction in GDP for the Eurozone. So Italy, Spain, even Germany. So, you know, the Eurozone is going to be under significant economic stress for, you know, certainly for this year, and I think beyond that. as well. And some quick dancing will be required, some hard decisions will be required by Eurozone leadership. But I think they will get there. I think the ECB made a couple of missteps under Mr. Lagarde's kind of early tenure, but I think they have recovered from those. And I think, the Eurozone is like any political construct. It is constrained by domestic realities, but I think they will do what's required. So I'm not in the camp that thinks the Eurozone is an existential risk. I think it's just going to be a little bit messy for a time.
I suppose the threat to it is as much political, isn't it? It's it's very, as you said earlier, David, it's very difficult to say because we don't know how long this is going to endure for. If this is another 6 weeks to three month event, then you minimise the political risk. But if it goes on longer than that, the potential for something politically quite extraordinary to happen in Italy or Spain grows.
Well, certainly, and I think inevitably this will go on for several months and into next year, almost certainly it will be a slow, hard grind out of it. So unemployment will keep on moving up, growth will be sluggish and the like, and so social and political pressure will mount. But in many European countries, the incumbent governments are seen to have done a tolerably good job. Clearly, there are some exceptions, but in many countries, the incumbent has received a bit of a bump in the popularity polls. Many have operated and responded reasonably well. And even in France yesterday, Mr. Macron was on TV saying, look, we got things wrong, but we're going to improve. And that was well received. So, I think Europe, the EU, the Eurozone as collectives, yes, they face real challenges, and those challenges won't go away soon. It's a combination of cyclical stresses, but also some underlying structural problems. But my guess is that Europe seems to, despite all of the claims about its kind of near extinction, it will keep on keeping on. So I don't worry so much about the Eurozone at the moment. If anything, I'm more concerned about the way that this virus is going to impact on emerging markets, a point that Anton made a moment ago. And also, frankly, on the US, where the intersection of the economic stresses with a uniquely dysfunctional political system at the moment, I think poses some real issues.
Mm. What, Andrew Wilson, on that question of Anton mentioned, we'll come back to the US in a second, but that question of deflation versus inflation, I know you're not sanguine about the medium-term inflation risk.
I think not. I mean, I think in the face of a crisis, then obviously we don't worry about inflation because the main worry is the opposite. And the risks of not intervening and spending a lot of money and running up debt are probably worse. You know, there's an interesting observation from India that the cost of the lockdown in both death and economy is worse than the cost of the virus itself. And politicians are driven by different motivations. Here, I think the question is not so much, it's not so much going into the crisis response. I think we can almost overshoot with alacrity there, because my observation at the front line of small and medium-sized enterprises, we're going to lose a lot of capacity here. There's another point I'll come back to in a minute. On the way out, however, there is a definite risk of us not emerging properly. Obviously, we depend on our central banks, which are independent, which have clear targets, to be able to manage that. And we're in a better position now than probably in, certainly in the post-war crises in that regard. I think that the thing that must worry us is that we have the risk of both hyperinflation and a banking crisis in years to come, as politicians respond in a disorderly fashion if things go as badly as they might go.
And what does that look like?
Well, it looks like politicians requiring the central bank to do things that they would rather not do. It looks like politicians requiring banks to run down their capital levels to such a wafer thin level that they're at risk. And I think, we can play out in our minds the scenario where that runs out. I don't think it's likely. I think it's very much a tail risk, but I think that it's there. I think the other big issue, Ian, if I may say, is if you think of the micro rather than the macro issues, and just thinking of my own company and many companies like me, we have a policy, for instance, of retaining on our balance sheet 6 months' cost. So we've been saving through our short life to try and do that. And why is it that the major corporations operate with wafer thin, with vapors in terms of their balance sheets, much like the banks did before the crisis in 2008? And is that sustainable? I don't think the regulator can fix that. But how do we get out of that to be more resilient rather than just be focused on productivity and efficiency? And if we do, long term, the economy is better off. But short term, it's very difficult for CEOs. Will they survive saying, for instance, that we're going to get rid of our just-in-time supply chain, that we're going to hold more cash against imagined disaster that might not happen? Given that the average tenure of a shareholder in the UK is about 6 months, and the average tenure of a CEO is about 5 years, will long-term rationality kick in, or will we continue to pursue a short-term return, which is what did for us in the banks? And this is one of the big issues that I think will emerge from this crisis, which is the crisis of what happens next for organisations, whether it's governments, charities, companies big or small. I think this is going to have, you know, radical challenges to how we think about it. If your company's failed and you go again, which might happen, you're not going to go again in the same terms. You're not going to take on lots of debt. You're going to try and go more slowly. You're maybe not going to take so many people on in the same generous terms. You're going to worry about keeping more money up your sleeve for a rainy day, because COVID-19 can be followed by COVID-20. There's no reason to think that we won't have another pandemic. So I think the world has changed very, very fundamentally.
But so that's a vindication almost of that people like to criticise Japan a lot for obvious reasons after the last 25 years. But that is a bit of a vindication of the Japanese corporate culture, isn't it? Of holding as much cash as possible and being cautious so you can actually sort of live off your cash for several years. I mean, Anton, do you think it's possible with the characteristics of British capitalism to change corporate behaviour in that way?
I think it's tricky. I think Andrew is right. I think it may require a revaluation. To be honest, I think it depends crucially on how quickly a solution is found to COVID-19. Yes, Andrew's right. There could be other tail risks. That, you know, who could have predicted that 10 years after the great financial crisis would have got another black swan type event? But I think if the crisis comes back quickly, then I suspect it won't change attitudes. If the crisis lasts, you know, 2 to 3 years because a vaccine is not perfect, or because, you know, we have to have, it will, like the Spanish flu, have a worse second and third wave, then absolutely. I think one factor in all of this, which I didn't mention, is could cause major scarring, is uncertainty. I mean, even if there isn't a change in corporate attitudes, let's just park that for a second. Even if there isn't, if you survive, unlike Andrew's sort of examples of some SMEs, what you will get is people being very, very careful about decisions over the next couple of years, unless they can see exactly how this is going to pan out. And I think that uncertainty will depress business investment. It will certainly depress also consumer investment. And to be honest, I think that is why the kind of scenarios we talked about earlier with the OBR, or indeed even the IMF's forecast, you know, is really optimistic, because I can't see these sort of scenarios of such a rapid bounce back unless the medical technological solution, you know, comes up trumps in the next few weeks. Just one last remark in all of this. If you look at the OBR scenario, it involves GDP recovering quickly, unemployment, you know, recovering more slowly, which means actually we have a productivity miracle over the next year, which nobody really believes, unless something miraculous is happening to the labor market. And so there's a lot of the detail of this is still to be worked out, and I think it will not look as pretty as some of the V-shaped scenarios.
Presumably, David, the psychological impact on consumers is going to be quite something. I was reflecting today on the numbers on the vulnerable number, which if you calculate it, the government seems to have underestimated it a lot, and there's maybe something like 2.5 million people, individuals, shielding on the vulnerable list, and they're in households, so you're who are also shielding as a result. So you're talking about somewhere between 4 and 6 million individuals, roughly, you know, not far off 10% of the population, who've just had the most extraordinary shock. They're not just self-isolating or social distancing, rather, they're properly isolating. I struggle to see those households going out and spending with abandon, David, in September. Do you?
No, it's very unlikely. And then September is a good case scenario from a restrictions point of view. I mean, I think restrictions will be with us for some time into the end of the year. So I think, you know, the history of, you know, significant economic shocks, be it the financial crisis or indeed previous episodes of pandemics elsewhere in the world, is that it does shape people's attitudes, their risk tolerance, their willingness to spend and invest. And for many households, they are extended in terms of levels of debt. Many of them don't have much in terms of liquid savings, so they're living kind of paycheck to paycheck. And you don't want to extend yourself. You know, if you are laid off, you're going to wait until you get a job. Even if you do have a job, partly to Andrew's point earlier, you want to accumulate a little bit of a buffer. So I think that residual uncertainty is going to shape people's preferences. They won't go on the, you know, they won't go to the movies, they won't go for a restaurant meal, they certainly won't be going for the overseas holiday in a way that even middle-class households may have done so before the pandemic. So I think that there is going to be a muffling effect on consumption spending, which is the engine of the UK economy. If people aren't spending in retail establishments, in hotels, and the like, that's going to have a depressing effect on the economy. So, you know, attitudes, you know, are going to be shaped, and the longer that this lasts for, the more pronounced that behavioural effect is going to be. So you can't just assume that the bounce back is going to be, you know, powered by deferred spending. I wasn't able to go on a holiday, you know, in April, so I'll go on it in September. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that spending has just been lost yeah. permanently.
Andrew, just we said we'd come back to the US just quickly. What do you think in terms of the way the US is handling it, what are the geopolitical implications? What flows from this?
Well, my Ian, I think they're very fundamental. I mean, we saw news today, for example, that the US was opposing funds flowing to emerging market economies. We saw the US questioning the funding for the World Health Organization. I think David's description of their political system remains understated and balanced. You know, it's not functioning as we would hope from a world leader. They're in the middle of an election campaign. There is hope within that, I suppose. But if the US crashes to the extent that we think it probably can, I mean, if you speak to people in the United States business community at the moment, they are thinking V-shaped recovery. Wall Street is predicting V-shaped recovery. If that doesn't happen, it takes away a source of demand for the world economy, which is dramatic, but at the same time, it also leads to a leadership point for the institutions of the world where if they disengage, if they retreat, then the coordination that Anton mentioned at the top of the call becomes much more difficult. If they renew, if they re-engage, if they lead again, then the possibility of us, you know, muddling our way through like the Eurozone, but at least picking our way through this becomes more important. So it's easy for all of us to scoff at the sort of the soap opera that is American politics, but it matters enormously to all of us. And I think that that's one of the things that you're right, Ian, we've got to watch in the days ahead.
Isn't the long-term story out of this going to be, if not quite we're still going to sell each other stuff, China and the West, it's the reconfiguration of that relationship and the most popular position that a politician can adopt in the West in the next 2-3 years, I'd suggest, is a position which is very, very China skeptic, whether that be the UK, thinking of stories like Huawei, or in the US, where I'm not sure that Trump is necessarily automatically going to be defeated. I mean, Anton, do you think it is going to be China versus the US and that's the story of the 2020s?
I think there's a risk given the rhetoric that's been adopted in the US, but of course one would hope that that might not persist, partly for self-interested reasons on the part of the US, whether it's under the current political leadership or a different political leadership. I think the smart countries, the countries that will do well out of this, are the countries that will avoid these kinds of dogmatic clashes because they will keep trade links flowing. I think the countries that will do well are the ones who are going to invest in both skills and innovation over the next few years as a way of trying to get out of this downswing. If you look at the lessons of all the big economic disruptions of the 20th century, whether it's pandemics or wars, you see that a period of great opportunity immediately in the decade following it. But that's generally the countries that do best are the ones that actually that play on the international scene, that invest in skills and innovation, that apply the technologies that are available out there. If any country tries to play it inwardly and in an autarky type sense, or decide not to invest in skills and innovation, frankly, they're making a big mistake.
Anton, you've brilliantly anticipated what was going to be my final question, where I was going to say, after this fascinating quite tough conversation on the economic prospects, I was going to ask what the more optimistic scenario is if it fades or scientists do something extraordinary in terms of a therapy or a vaccine. How quickly can we get back up to speed, and what does that look like? And I think you've answered that very well, Anton, in terms of investment and skills and the approach to the crisis. So, David, what does an optimistic scenario look like?
Well, and obviously there's the vaccine question. So we hope that the 12-month window gets brought forward. I think the positive message, I guess, to take, if you look around the world and you look at the jurisdictions that have managed the crisis well, both from a public health perspective, but also from an economic policy response perspective, which often are smaller countries, from New Zealand to Taiwan to Switzerland, even to Ireland, not perfectly, but well. They are countries with strong state capacity, strong institutions, strong government, strong social trust, strong underlying economic policy settings in terms of skills, innovation, research, and the like. And so my optimistic takeaway is that countries will realize that actually investing in those things, investing in state capacity, investing in appropriate policy settings, actually does pay dividends. And the jurisdictions that have had a much harder run of it, we talked just now about the US, the UK hasn't handled things perfectly, and there are obvious issues in and around their political systems, are countries that struggle. So my hope is that out of the crisis, unlike what we saw in the global financial crisis a decade ago, out of this crisis comes a recognition that actually investing in those capabilities is a good and worthwhile thing to do. And a premium is placed again on good governance, which will build resilience, hopefully, for a problem down the road. So that's, if you like, a longer term case for optimism.
Andrew, isn't there an optimistic case to be made that in the midst of this extraordinary trauma, once you come through this, people are incredibly inventive, and those animal spirits that we've talked about many times before come to the fore, and that people will want to start businesses, they will want to reconnect with social animals, and people will find new things to invent and new ways through this?
Well, we hope so. I mean, I think the most optimistic thing, Ian, that I can think of is that this accelerates the transition to a new approach that we knew we were going to go through anyway, whether it's because of climate change or artificial intelligence or the demographic time bomb that's challenging many Western economies. We knew stuff had to change anyway. I think the biggest worry bead for me is around the intergenerational disequity of it. How one or two generations are passing on an enormous burden to the next and coming ones. And I think if we can resolve for that, then we can reach an equilibrium which is a much more sustainable and happy one. And I think to Anton and David's points earlier, I mean, I think the key thing is that we don't unlearn the lessons of history and the lessons, for example, of the Enlightenment, that we don't retreat behind national boundaries, we don't retreat behind populism, and that we re-engage in a way that we know is going to have to be different because the world's going to be different, but that we keep learning all of the things that human history have taught us. And yes, have faith in the fact that, as Anton says, innovation will see us through. Creativity is the most important thing, much more important than anything else, and we've got that in abundance. So I think we have got a better future to look forward to, but the transition is going to be a difficult one.
Well, I'll wrap things up there, and just by saying thank you for a fascinating discussion. Thank you to Anton Muscatelli, Andrew Wilson, and David Skilling. Thank you for listening to this Reaction podcast. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, it's very easy to become one. Just go to the website, www.reaction.life. But until next time, thank you very much for listening.